This is The Takeout.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
With Major Garrett.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
At this defining moment, change has come to America.
And we will make America great again.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. This is Major Garrett. You're listening to The Takeout. I am joined, as I am every week, by the world's greatest sidekick, Steve Shigaris, political editor of CBS News. Steve, please say hello.
Hello, Major. I'm the Barney Rubble to your Fred Flintstone.
Absolutely. And I'm the Fred Flintstone-ish person you'll ever want to meet in Podcastville, kids. Let me tell you that. As you well know, new episodes of The Takeout are available every Friday morning. That's how you're probably listening to us. We invite you to subscribe, rate, and comment on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. The subscribe part, really important. Then the rate part, even more important, because that's how we get higher and higher in the iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play matrix. And the matrix, as everyone knows, really, really important. So, the happy sounds you hear around us. One of the most venerable watering holes in all of Washington, D.C., because of its proximity to the United States Capitol, Bullfeathers Restaurant. And joining us at our table for this episode 9 of the Takeout Podcast, North Carolina Republican Congressman Mark Meadows, also head of the Freedom Caucus. Congressman, thank you for joining
us. It's great to be here. You know, 9, hopefully it's not for 9 lives. You
not
know,
for so 9 lives, exactly. That, okay, so we're in the middle of a very hot news environment. I don't need to tell you that, Congressman. And not only is it a hot news environment, you're at the very center of the hotness.
Hopefully I'm not creating it.
You're creating a little bit of it. A little bit of it. So let's get to the news straight away. What is the current situation with the leadership drafted and President Trump endorsed repeal and replace Obamacare legislation?
Well, I think the current situation is there's not enough votes to support that. And it has nothing to do with the president. It really has to do with the legislation. So if this was a personality contest, I think the president picks up the phone, calls a number of members, said, I want you to vote for it, and they probably would. And yet, when we really look at the legislation, the number of no votes that are out there currently today does not bode well for bringing it to the floor next week.
How far away are they, the leadership?
I don't know their whip count. I know my whip count, and I would suggest that there's at least 40 no's that are out there and probably another 20 undecideds. They're working those tonight. You could have seen the whip on the House floor, both him and the deputy whip trying to twist some arms and get him to yes.
Right, and for terminology's sake, whip is a term of art used in Washington, D.C., primarily in the House of Representatives, because that's where the art of persuasion, the art of leadership pressuring, the art of presidential involvement tries to whip up votes when they don't currently exist. That's less true in the Senate. It's much more true in the House. You have elaborate whip leadership teams or whip minority teams that work the vote, and that's what's going on now. But the whipping, I don't get the impression, is moving very many people in any particular direction.
Well, it hasn't to this date. And of course, it picks up in earnest. You know, and you mentioned the difference in the two. So it's kind of like the House is kind of like this restaurant. So it's noisy. It gets back and forth, and it has all of this. But then you've got the Senate, if there's a place across the way with cots where they take naps, that would be the Senate.
There are 30 members, right, of the House Freedom Caucus. Were you folks consulted by the House Speaker and by the President before this legislation was presented to the world?
Well, before the rollout, here's the thing is, a lot of people said, well, everybody was part of the process back in October. Well, back in October, no one necessarily believed that there was going to be a President Trump, and so that's part of it.
Probably but say that in November, too.
Well, that's probably true, as you look at that. But really, when they were talking about concepts back then, we all agreed to some certain concepts. We needed to lower premiums. This is the way that we would do it. But there was never any legislation. So the legislation gets leaked first by a publication here in town called Politico. And so that's the first I see any legislation is on a leaked copy that I'm reading about. And then it gets rolled out on a Monday night when we're all out of, we're not here for votes. We come in on Tuesday and they roll out the version that they're pushing right now.
So what does that process just tell you? And what dynamic does it create within your group of 30 House Freedom Caucus members.
Yeah, and so let me correct one thing. You know, we're probably bigger than 30.
Okay.
And we don't give out our numbers, but we probably have a reach of, you know, between 40 and 45. Some are not in the Freedom Caucus, but whenever we do our whip count, we've got a real sophisticated whip app on my iPhone that literally will count the votes immediately. And so with that, I think most of our members were real concerned that some of the things that were in the bill, this was the first chance they had to look at it, and they said, well, I don't know that I agree with that, and who put this in here? And so I think that's what you're seeing is some of that back and forth right now.
And what are the hang-ups?
You know, I think the biggest hang-up, as I see, is that it's not conservative enough for conservative support. It's not liberal enough for liberals to support. And so it's interesting because we're getting calls at our office from Democrats who say don't repeal it. We're getting calls from our conservatives who say don't vote for this bill. So it makes for a very small kind of in-the-middle approach. So it really, the hang-up, your question, and I'll try to answer it, is that it doesn't fully repeal, and it doesn't lower premiums. And probably more important is the second part, is it doesn't lower premiums.
But Ryan will argue it does in the long term.
Yeah, and so if you look at CBO, he says it lowers premiums 10% in 10 years. Well, now, I can tell you that premiums have gone up in the last 3 years in my state of 100%. And so 10% over 10 years is nothing to get a glass of champagne out about. But when you look at the CBO numbers, anybody that's 40 years of age and older in poverty, actually their premiums go up. So it's an average of 10%, but it's really those who are 21 to 40 that see a 20 to 25% reduction, and those over 40 and some up in the 50s and 60s see a 20 to 25% increase. And so that's the troubling part.
And so there's been a lot of dialogue. National Review, Heritage Foundation has put out some statements and some policy papers urging conservatives to reject this and not buy into the idea that this is your only opportunity, this is your only choice, the binary choice that House Speaker Paul Ryan has spoken of. And even Sean Spicer said, hey, this is your only chance.
Right.
If you vote against this, you're essentially voting against repealing the Affordable Care Act, and therefore telling your voters you were not keeping your promise. Talk to me about that.
Well, we're all about keeping promises, but I can tell you that the legislative process doesn't work that way. That's why you have amendments. That's why you have the whole debate back and forth. And to suggest that you roll something out with no debate on the House floor and you got an up or down vote, well, very few things have ever happened that way. And I can tell you over the last 4 or 5 years, that's not the way that it has happened. Normally we have, you know, a back and forth. You have hearings. You have a number of things that go on in terms of crafting a piece of legislation. Now,
getting buy-in is what you do in that process.
Yeah, you do. But, I mean, you know, to have a rollout and to have a markup and have a vote within 2 weeks, that's unheard of. Now, this is a special time, and let me tell you, we've got to keep up with the president. He's actually working much faster than members of Congress, and so shame on us. I think it's important that we don't take a break other than for religious holidays for the next 100 days and come in and get it done, whether it's doing this or tax reform or you know, any other important topic.
Where is the president in terms of the Freedom Caucus? Has he been speaking to you? Is he listening to your concerns? Is there going to be any movement on that, do you think?
You know, we have been talking to the president. We've had some ongoing dialogue. I've talked to the White House administration as recent as a couple of hours ago. And so when we look at that, they get an A+. I was on the way over here, I was telling someone, it's so surprising to see the kind of interaction coming from this White House in terms of policy people willing to pick up the phone and call you, and you've got a concern, we'll get you an answer. It blows me away, and to see that kind of openness is certainly to be applauded.
Congressman, we're here at Bull Feathers. It's dinner time, which means you get to order your dinner. So,
what do you want? Wow, that's great. You know, I think I'll take some chicken fingers if we can. You know, just some chicken fillets would be fine. Would that work? Yeah, just kind of like what this gentleman right here has.
And I'll have the Cajun burger.
The Cajun burger.
So you're gonna take the Cajun burger and take it hot.
Yeah. You want it cooked?
Oh, medium well, please. All the foodies now are totally off the reservation.
Yeah.
They're like, oh God, that guy's irredeemable.
I'm going for the turkey club.
always very delicate with your venue choices, Shigeru.
Trying to keep it simple.
Let me ask you this,
Congressman. No Greek salad or anything like that, right?
Not tonight.
So, Congressman, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Because Americans interacting with healthcare for the better part of 20 years have had to deal with premiums.
Right.
Premiums and access, but mostly premiums. Even if you have an employer-provided insurance company, if you're in the individual market, premiums are the things that affect your family's bottom line and your ability to have that sense of security and affordability. You talked about this legislation not dealing with that. How do you deal with that? What kind of amendments or specific policy do you want in there that will remedy this or have a chance of remedying this?
Well, one of the things that we're looking at is to actually truly try to make consumers have more choices. So let me put it in a property casualty time frame, in what we look at. So if you were to buy homeowners insurance, if I were to tell you, you can buy homeowners insurance, and by the way, you have to buy boat insurance and motorcycle insurance, but you don't own a boat or a motorcycle. That's what we've done with the Affordable Care Act. We basically packaged it all together, so you got to pay for this, and yeah, you may not use that. We've got to do better than that, so to make sure that you can do homeowners, or if you just have a motorcycle, you can just buy motorcycle insurance. We need to do the same on the medical insurance side of things.
Does that medical insurance come with a basic set of requirements of any kind that you have to have, which most state insurance commissioners require, so you don't have this sort of dive to the bottom with you have low premiums and low deductibles, but you have almost no practical coverage?
Well, and you're getting in the policy wonk side of this, and so
that's major.
I know. I ruin every conversation
but
that way.
But I talked to the North Carolina insurance commissioner just the other day about that very subject, and what we really have to do is understand that sometimes, maybe for me, I want a catastrophic plan, which I can use an HSA to pay for my out-of-pocket stuff, and then I have a higher deductible. But for somebody else, that doesn't work as well. What we've done is we've actually put it all together, which we have the maximum out-of-pocket is $7,500 now. But I can tell you that I'm on Obamacare, and so I'm spending over $12,000 a year for my coverage, and I got a $7,500 deductible. So I'm basically spending $18,000 and getting nothing for it other than that catastrophic.
That is the voice of Mark Meadows, Congressman from North Carolina, head of the Freedom Caucus, at the very center of the debate in Washington right now about the fate of the repeal, replace Obamacare legislation. He will be joining us for the entire Episode 9, which you're listening to, The Happy Sound Around Us, Bull Feathers Restaurant, right near Capitol Hill. I'm Major Garrett, joined by Steve Shigaris, and you are, of course, listening to The Takeout.
The problem is this, though. The leadership in the House is weak-kneed, and they are afraid. They are afraid to lead with freedom and capitalism, so they're giving you something that's half as much as Obamacare but doesn't fix the problem.
That's the voice of Rand Paul, senator from Kentucky, one of many unsuccessful Republican challengers to Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential campaign. He was talking about the very issue we're discussing with our very special guest, Mark Meadows, Republican congressman from North Carolina, at the center of this debate, and a leader in the House Freedom Caucus. And because he is a leader in that caucus, he is at the center of this debate because, and I want to ask you this, Congressman, there is a sense at the White House where I hang out every day.
Right.
And it's kind of a, I don't want to say panicky sense, but it's an anxious sense that if this gets off the rails,
right,
then a lot of other things will be stymied as well. That
well,
the Democrats will be emboldened, Republicans will, the divisions within the Republicans that led to this legislative initiative failing will fester and grow deeper. Tax reform gets stalled or put off. Infrastructure. A lot of these other items that the president campaigned on may fall by the wayside. Are we talking about something of that magnitude?
Well, it could be, but I think that's why my commitment to try to find the sweet spot is imperative. I mean, we've got to get there, and we've got to repeal it, and I believe that we can. But, yes, you're right. If we stop this, that means tax reform doesn't happen. That means that what we have is a real battle over infrastructure. You know, in any given year, there is about three, what I would say, must-pass pieces of legislation. This time there's seven. You know, so when you really look at it, in this first year, we're going to have seven. You got the debt ceiling, you got appropriations, you've got, you know, budget reconciliation, you got a new budget coming up. So when you look at all of these different things, it becomes a real do or die moment. And the president is not willing to take no for an answer. I mean, he wants to get it done. And so I think the American people want it done. And that's part of draining the swamp.
So we talk about this sweet spot, right? It seems for some Republicans, the sweet spot must include the Medicaid expansion and must include these tax subsidies, right?
Right.
Now, I'm just going to throw some numbers at you. The House Freedom Caucus, we know of 30 members.
Yeah.
Of the 30, 28 had competitive races in 2016.
Right.
The average margin of victory for members in the Freedom Caucus, 31 points.
Yeah.
You were actually below average at 28.
Yeah.
But 31 points.
I'm in a marginal district.
Right.
I mean, I've got Asheville. Right. Come on. You know,
28%.
You know, you don't know how they were.
A beautiful city, by the way.
Yeah, but do you know how they define my district? San Francisco, surrounded by Mayberry, surrounded by Jesse Helms. And that's about right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's good.
That's pretty good.
That's
28
good.
Yeah.
But anyway, 31 point average, not a lot of political risk for the House Freedom Caucus to hold tight to their principles. Is there any empathy? Is there any willingness to move toward Republicans who feel a lot of pressure from their constituents to get to more of a moderate view on this bill?
There is empathy among some of us, and I'm one of those. I mean, I can tell you that I had a conversation with some of our more moderate members today, which we call the Tuesday group, which is literally, if you know, you do that same analysis, they're in D+1, D+2 districts, R+1, which, you know, for your listeners is basically just means it can go
it's
either
a
way.
Yeah, right?
It's a toss-up. It's a toss-up. Up every 2 years.
And so when we look at that, I had a conversation with them. The Medicaid expansion portion of this is really the easiest thing to solve, primarily because I know that they have a different district than I do. Now, my state didn't expand. You know, Indiana did. Kentucky did. But if we get the Obamacare repeal and replacement part right, then what we've got is we actually can work better on the Medicaid expansion part. You know, I'm getting calls from governor of Mississippi the other day. He called me. I met with the governor from Maine. They're real concerned that they've taken the political hit, and now all of a sudden we're going to give it over to a more moderate or liberal thinking. But, yeah, I think there's a real empathy, if not even a sympathy at times, for just the tough votes that they have to take. And for me, I'm committed to finding that with them. In fact, I suggested today for us, the Freedom Caucus, to have a meeting with the Tuesday group. Bring us all together in one room. You know, if we're there together and the president comes in, I guarantee we get a deal somewhere. And so they, much to their credit, they've agreed to meet.
And that could be conceivably anywhere from 60 to 70 votes.
Oh, yeah, right there. Because, I mean, really right now what you have is you have moderates who are whipping probably more undecided than no. You have conservatives whipping more no than undecided. But both of those would, you know, be a 60 to 80 vote total right there.
So let me ask you this. Because you know the rap and the rep of the Freedom Caucus, or those who are from the Tea Party inspiration.
Major, I can't believe you would bring this up.
Exactly.
I mean, I thought this was going to be a friendly interview. No,
and the rep is, you guys don't know how to legislate, don't want to legislate, have no interest in making government work. You're so atavistically opposed to government functioning that you can't build a coalition or a consensus.
Yeah.
Is this a big test for you on that score and on that rap?
Well, I don't know that this is a big test because the American people are really with us. You know, you mentioned Heritage and some of the others, but it's not just them. I mean, when you go looking at almost every conservative group, and then you look at the American Hospital Association and a whole bunch of others that would typically maybe look at more of a, I won't say liberal, but more of a, institutional. I mean, they're not normally supporters of Mark Meadows, I guess you might say. But yet, both of them are coming out opposed to this bill. But yes, I mean, it's a valid point. And here's what you can say: we are willing to move more than halfway to get a deal. And that's something that doesn't get reported, so you're reporting it here because that doesn't normally – getting along doesn't normally make headlines. And so I can give you a little story on how actually we've been involved. Boy, now that looks like a turkey club. I tell you what.
Club has arrived. Our food has arrived. There's another
food
turkey
is club. Arrived.
Who gets the other turkey club?
Okay.
And they're the chicken fingers. Yeah, and I can tell you, fingers. I sampled them before you arrived. They are mighty, mighty
tasty.
Yeah,
looks good. It smells good, too. So, but to give you a prime example, I mean, one of my passions is foreign policy. So you know, finding a conservative who loves foreign policy is hard to do, but it's a passion of mine. And so on the Hezbollah sanctioning bill, which actually is now law, I introduced that the first year when I was a freshman, and I had to go out and find somebody to actually co-sponsor it with me. And so here was a conservative member of Congress, a Republican, knowing that if they looked down and said, here's this Freedom Caucus guy, and actually that was before the Freedom Caucus, but here's this Freedom Caucus guy. So I went out and found a Democrat. Guess who I found?
Tell me.
Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
There you go.
So now her job is to make sure that I don't have one. So I went to her, and we found that our common love and passion was actually Israel. And so we put it together. Much to her credit, she co-sponsored. When she figured out I was not in a swing district, she co-sponsored.
Right.
and so then...
Well,
then
so he's going to win anyway.
Yeah,
never mind.
Yeah,
we're not going to throw any money in that district anyway.
So as we look at that, that's what we need to do here. Now, we need to do it within our own party, but I think we
and
can.
And how soon do you need to do it? What kind of an hourglass is this president and this legislation on? 1 week, 2 weeks, three weeks?
The pressure cooker is huge, yeah. I would say that the internal goal is to have it done by our Easter break.
Mid-April.
Yeah, which, you know, we're staring at just a very short fuse there. And quite frankly, we've got to get it right. We have about 7 days. So whoever's listening to this, in 7 days, if we don't have it figured out, we're going to miss that deadline just because it'll go from here to the Senate, and the Senate has to come back, and we will have held up that train that you were talking about with tax reform and all the other things.
Oh, so... When you say if we haven't figured it out, help our audience understand what it looks like that you figured it out.
All right. Well, when it figures out.
Is that a
out.
Press conference with everyone locking arms and saying, here it is, and we're supporting it, and we're going to march forward on the House floor and going to vote for it? What does it look like?
Well, it could look that way. It generally doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
As you well know, it generally doesn't.
That was kind of a setup question.
Yeah, we don't sing Kumbaya and get out there. Actually, it's more or less begrudgingly coming and saying, yes,
oh, all right.
I'll do it if I'm going to take one for the team here. And so as we look at that, I think the real key is I've spent a lot of time on the Senate over the last week or so talking to different senators to find out moderate and conservative senators where their interest lies. And so we've got to get there, but we've got to start talking and saying this is a have to. This is a definite line in the sand. And these are all negotiations, and that requires us to be honest. And you know, here in Washington, D.C., you know better than any, people being honest, sometimes that's an oxymoron.
That's the voice of Mark Meadows, congressman from North Carolina, originally from Tampa, Florida. We're going to talk a little bit about Mark Meadows the person when we come back for segment three. I'm joined, as always, by Steve Shigaris, the world's greatest podcast sidekick. The happy sound you hear around us, Bullfeathers Restaurant. Dinner has arrived. My Cajun burger looks spectacular. I'm ready to dive in. You are always,
Major.
And we hope perpetually.
Fantastic.
Well, thank you, Mr. President. Thank you. You're fantastic. Well, I don't know. Anyway, you're listening to The Take.
Listening to The Takeout.
I'm Major Garrett, coming to you from Bullfeathers Restaurant. Dinner has arrived. Steve Shigaris is with me. Say hello again, Steve.
Hello, Major.
Mark Meadows, congressman from North Carolina. And for those of you who are curious, what the Cajun burger is, essentially is a great burger, grilled onions, blue cheese, tomato, lettuce, great fries. Excellent.
Medium
congressman,
well.
How are your... chicken fingers. They're not like fingers. They're like
big heaps of chicken or hands or something.
Right.
Yeah,
like a manhole covers or something.
They're actually very good. Very
excellent.
Tasty.
And your turkey club.
Shigeru's. They were not shy with the mayo, which I'm a big fan of.
Well, if you're a big fan of tartar sauce, and we know from your history on this podcast, you certainly are, mayo tartar sauce, very closely related.
It's a lovely
kissing
condiment.
Kissing cousins, as condiments go. Congressman, there we go. There's the happy sound.
Finally a rim shot.
Exactly. Congressman, tell us a little bit about yourself. Grew up in Tampa, eldest of three kids, right?
Right.
Had a weight problem as a kid. How did that affect
you? Yeah, you did good research there. Thanks a lot. You know,
we're hoping
the Google
pictures.
Yeah, the Google machine works really well.
Yeah, but my wife said, "Why in the heck did you ever tell them that story?"
And it's a great story, though.
Yeah. Not only the weight problem, but how did you describe yourself once?
Well, I was a fat nerd.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And so now I'm an overweight nerd. You know, so it's
not
just,
at all, folks.
But as we look at that, it was, you know, I'm a typical kid, you know, and people say, well, you were a nerd. Well, I'll give you a classic example. I was the president of the Sound and Lighting Club. So you're
what
making news here tonight.
What exactly does that mean?
So, you know, my joy was taking a mono system and turning it into stereo, you know, and so
transformation.
Wow. Yeah. So this would have been in the '70s,
right?
Yeah.
Disco music.
Yeah. Well, disco. Mm. Yeah, came in right about the time I was graduating.
Wow.
You know, and we could do the Bee Gees or Staying Alive, whatever you want to do. Yeah.
There's another part of your biography I want to talk about. Your parents both worked. Both of my parents worked.
Right.
I was the youngest of three, and by the time I was sort of the chore doing age, which was like 11 or 12, both my sister and brother were gone, and all the chores fell to me. But
that's unfair.
That's the way it was. But you had to distribute them among your siblings, and you grew up in a household with responsibilities and equities that you had to work out with your siblings.
Without a doubt. And I think when you look at that, it makes you appreciate the value of work, but it also makes you understand that sometimes when you're doing clothes for yourself or doing your laundry or doing the things that single moms do every day.
Absolutely.
It really speaks to me even today. You know, when I think about the single moms and what they have to do, I can think back to when I was a kid and I was having to do this and just trying to manage the little household things. It was just me, you know, and my siblings. And yet to think about doing that as a parent with children around, it makes me tear up to think about it at times.
I mean, I agree with you. It sort of puts a different perspective on the whole idea that being a latchkey kid is somehow this doleful, terrible, depressing, necessarily negative thing. It can be, and I'm not suggesting that in every instance it isn't, but in some instances it can be, if not empowering, at least it gets you connected to responsibility, doing things, fending for yourself, and I would also argue being a capable modern American husband.
Well, you're right. You grow up fast. I got married when I was 20, barely turned 20. We bought a home actually as we were getting married, closed on it a month before we got married. And so, you know, when I looked at that, I look back at my kids now and I go, how in the world, look how young they are. And I think about, well, I was married and
mortgaging and everything
at age 20. And yet, as we see that, I think one of the wonderful things is it just shows that the American dream is still alive. I grew up with very humble beginnings, as you mentioned, two working parents, and yet, who would have thought that I'm now in the most powerful place in the world? You know, there's a picture in the rotunda here in Washington, and when you look at it, it's the embarkation, so you see all the pilgrims coming over. Well, there's a guy there that has a Bible held open, and his name is Elder William Brewster. Well, he's my 11th great-grandfather. So who would have thought that his picture would have been in the rotunda and that his 11th great-grandson would be serving in a powerful place? So it just talks about the vision and the greatness of America, which is still alive today, I believe.
I know Steve is dying to talk to you about the sandwich shop. So
well, I was going to ask. There's a lot of time between the 20-year-old homeowner and the 2012 election to Congress. So what's the road from A to B?
I think probably in North Carolina, it's that sandwich shop, which I left the electric utility business in Tampa. I left a very good career. Everybody said, well, you want it. You climbed the corporate ladder very quickly. And at that point, I said, the worst thing happens if I go out and start a sandwich shop. I end up where most of the people that I went to school with, you know. And
but where does the idea of a sandwich shop come in for the kid who was the president of the Sound and Light Club in high school?
Well, I did a little cooking when I was in high school, you know, and then a little cooking when I was in college. And so, you know, from a Kentucky Fried Chicken to a short order cook and waiter and all that. And what I do is I look at needs. And so that really defines. It's interesting you picked up on that, because what I go is I'll look at everything that everybody passes by. And I said, okay, this is what this little town needed, which was fast food. Now, I can tell you a terrible story. We opened up the very first day, and I knew so little about prepping that when they ordered a BLT, I started cooking the bacon. That is not what you do.
20 minutes later.
The first day, we had a great day. It was $400. I figured I'd go broke in 6 weeks. We didn't. The business did well. We sold it a couple of years later and then started starting businesses after that.
No food service training whatsoever.
No, which is a mistake. You know, if you're listening here, that is not what I recommend.
Not an easy business.
Yeah. So, you're on a desert island. You have one sandwich you can order. What do you want?
You know, I don't order sandwiches. I can tell you.
Having
you know, our busiest
700,000
yeah,
of
yeah,
them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Our busiest day, you know, I would serve. We had a little 50 seat, and so I can remember the busiest day was in October, which is a big time in North Carolina. I served 552 people for lunch. And so that was turning the tables 10 times. I said, close the door, shut it off. And so now if there's a sandwich, you notice tonight, I didn't order a sandwich. I don't do that ever again. It's kind of like if you work with it, you don't ever want to touch it again.
Right. When you think about politics, what is its ultimate goal? And how do you see yourself fitting in the machinery of American politics?
Well, I don't fit in the machinery of American politics. That's a great question. Here's where I see it is I see that I guess I have a little bit of a Pollyanna kind of view, is that a member of Congress or anyone that is representing someone else, they have their convictions, their moral convictions, but outside of that, they truly should be a representative of the people and not of a party. And which makes it extremely tough here in Washington, D.C. You know, that you get the old speech, you've been here, you know it, this is not your first rodeo. So when you get here, are you going to be part of the team?
Right.
Well, my team's back home in North Carolina. It will continue to be in North Carolina, which makes it, as you know, it has been difficult at times personally up here on Capitol Hill. When you look at your allegiance to the people that vote for you, it can make for interesting times, we might want to say.
Because you're leaned on, and the conversation is abrupt. It's sometimes highly pressurized. Look, you're here.
Right.
You're part of this team. This team demands you do this so it can function.
Right.
You felt that pressure. You've lived with it. You've been sanctioned by a former Speaker of the House, John Boehner.
Right. Right. And so when you look at that, here's what you have to do, is make sure that your votes are principled and not ideological. And sometimes people confuse the two. They say, well, he's just an ideologue. Well, the truth is tonight, if you had 30 Democrats that came in, I could just as easily sit down, have a meal with them. They would do any. I could call 30 Democrats tonight. If I had a problem at my house, they would come and help me. And so what it's all about is actually trying to bridge that gap. And that doesn't happen in Washington, D.C. as much as it should. And yet, at the same time, I'll have people who say, you know, I can't stand you supporting this or supporting that, but I really respect the fact that you're willing to do it and do it in a respectful and nice way. And I think that's what we have to do.
That's the voice of Mark Meadows, congressman from North Carolina, at the very center of a very important and possibly history-determining debate in Washington in this very early stage of President Trump's administration. Repeal, replace the Affordable Care Act. Will it happen? Can it happen? And Mark Meadows is at the center of that debate. You are listening to The Takeout. As you know, you can listen to this podcast every Friday morning. We provide you an extra Takeout Outtake Especial on Tuesdays. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. And we'd love for you to go to takeoutpodcast.com. Follow us, like us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Takeout Podcast. That's at Takeout Podcast. Hate the show? You really don't hate the show.
Nobody hates
the show.
Come on,
you love the show.
But if you hate the show.
but you may need to vent. And venting is a very elaborate and widely defined term. If you do so, we will listen. We will not read your vents on the air, but we will listen. Takeout podcast at cbsnews.com. I'm Major Garrett, joined as always by the world's greatest podcast sidekick, Steve Shigaris, editor, political editor of CBS News. Our guest has been Mark Meadows, congressman from North Carolina. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been great to be with you.
You've been listening to The Takeout.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Farhi, Nick Feynman, and CBS Radio News. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and visit takeoutpodcast.com for more information.
They don't make movies like they used to, is that right? What a difference.